Welcome to the Maine Historical Society podcast. These podcasts explore the experiences of Maine people in a changing world and the connections between local, state, and national history. To learn more about our programs, please visit us online at www.mainehistory.org/programs.
Hello and welcome to this virtual program hosted by Maine Historical Society and Longfellow House, Washington's headquarters, National Historic Site. I'm Kathleen Newman. It is February 23rd, 2022, and this is Whence These Stories, a panel discussion for Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's 215th birthday, History in Longfellow's Poetry. This is a big year for anniversaries for all of us. So Henry, we're marking his 215th birthday. His birthday is actually February 27th, so we're celebrating it a little bit early this year. Maine Historical Society is also marking 200 years as an organization. And Longfellow House, Washington's headquarters is marking, I think, 50 years as a National Historic Site. So we're glad we could assemble this team of experts this evening to talk a bit about Henry, his work, his poetry. We're going to look at three of his poems, maybe the three poems that he's remembered for the most: Paul Revere's Ride, Evangeline, A Tale of Acadie, and The Song of Hiawatha. What motivated Longfellow to write these poems? What history did he draw upon, and what history did he ignore when he was writing them? In what ways might some of these poems be problematic? How are they looked upon and studied today? That's going to be what we'll discuss this evening. So I want to introduce my panelists. First, I'm going to introduce our co-host, Emily Levine, who's coming from Longfellow House, Washington's headquarters. Hi, Emily.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us and for helping us put this panel together. And our other panelists, tonight we have Lise Pelletier. She is the former director of the Acadian Archives at the University of Maine, Fort Kent. And she holds a master's in French from the University of Maine and a bachelor's in French and English from Université de Montcalm, Campus de Munston, which I'm sure I'm not pronouncing beautifully. She has taught French, French literature, and Acadian history, participated in the writing and translation of Acadian roots images of the St. John Valley, and participated in three documentaries about Acadia and of the lands and forests. Thanks for being here, Lise.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Katrina Phillips, a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. Katrina earned her BA and PhD in history from the University of Minnesota and is an assistant professor of American Indian history at McAllister College. Her first book examines the role of Native history in the creation and maintenance of regional tourism economies, and her current research centers on Ojibwe activism, environmentalism, and tourism on and around Red Cliff. Thank you, Katrina, for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And last but not least, Robert Schrimp. He is the Research and Adult Program Director at Paul Revere Memorial Association, Paul Revere House. He also serves as the editor for the Revere House Gazette, Revere House Radio Podcast, and Revere Express blog. He holds a bachelor's in broadcast and electronic communications and history from Marquette University and a PhD in history from Boston University. Thanks for being with us, Robert.
Thanks, Kathleen. Pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to start off the questions. And maybe we could start by answering in the order I introduced you. We'll go Lise, Katrina, Robert. Could each of you describe a little bit about the work that you do and how or where that work intersects with Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and the poem that you're going to speak a little bit about tonight?
Hi, this is Lise. So until July, I was the director of the Acadian Archives at the University of Maine of Fort Kent. I am also the president of the Maine Acadian Heritage Council of the Upper St. John Valley. So both institutions actually share a mission. Their mission is to celebrate, to disseminate and preserve the history, culture and language of the Acadians of the St. John Valley, that is of Northern Maine. Acadians are the French who settled in the colony called Acadia and not the other French colony, which was called New France. In 1785, survivors of the ethnic cleansing, Acadians, came to the Madawaska area to find a permanent home. That is what started the permanent settlement of Madawaska, and then, of course, it was transformed with the Webster-Ashburton Treaty, because then the North Shore of the St. John River was deemed Canadian, whereas the Southern Shore became American and was thereafter included in the state of Maine. So I became aware of the poem in my studies as an undergraduate student, and I felt it was a lovely poem. I was studying it from the literary point of view, but I also had some knowledge of Acadian history. And although I enjoyed the poem tremendously, in terms of the workmanship, in terms of the reverence which the poet described both the heroine Evangeline and the tragedy that separated her from her fiance, I was disappointed that the poem only barely touched upon the ethnic cleansing of Acadia that is to this day the determining element of identity any Acadian today. So I'm going to stop there.
Thank you. Katrina?
So I get to talk about the Song of Hiawatha tonight. And so I teach Native history, history of the American West at McAllister College. I might be the only one who is solidly situated in the Midwest Great Lakes region right about now. And so I teach courses on numerous facets of these histories. I teach pop culture and public history. And so these topics, as well as my proximity to Minnehaha Falls, to Minnehaha Avenue, to Hiawatha Avenue, and, you know, to a lot of these places here in the Twin Cities, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul, that have really kind of, I don't know if glommed onto is the like most academic way to say it, but have really kind of laid claim in a sense to a lot of the kind of place-based history that this poem touches on. And so, you know, I've been thinking a lot since you asked me to do this, just how to kind of make that entree into this conversation. And, you know, I'm also not a literature scholar, I'm a historian, but this is the poem that I think really resonates the most with the work that I do. And, you know, I'm also Ojibwe, and that never really factored into, you know, my first encounters with this poem when I was a kid. But it's honestly, it's kind of incredible to have, you know, had the chance to go back and in a sense, kind of like re-engage with it. And, you know, to see so many Ojibwe words that I recognized and to be able to, you know, now that I'm an adult and things like that, to really have a chance to do a little bit more work with this and to really see what is in this poem that has, honestly, it's kind of surrounded me my whole life.
Thank you. Robert.
Yeah, so, and Robert Chen for everybody. You know, at the Revere House, my role is both kind of a research element and a programmatic element as well. So a lot of what I do and what we do is both producing content and, you know, primary source scholarship. As Katrina said, I come at this as well from the historian perspective, not a literary perspective. So that's certainly what I'm bringing to the table here. And, you know, in terms of the content that you know, we do at the Paul Revere Memorial Association, of course, in a lot of ways, it centers on, you know, on Paul Revere and the Midnight Ride itself. But I think one of the gratifying aspects that I've seen from the house in my time there is, you know, how many different touch points there are over the, you know, now 342 years that the physical structure has been there. So we have opportunities to talk about, you know, 17th century history, certainly slavery in the North End, and an attachment to the first owners of the house, Robert Howard, and of course one enslaved individual named Samuel in the house as well. Those experiences, all the way up to, of course, immigration stories of the 19th century through, you know, modern Boston and 21st century into the future. What is climate change going to look like for places like the Revere House and the North End of Boston? All of that is to say, in a lot of ways, so much of what we do comes back to Longfellow and comes back to the poem, because in a lot of ways, that's the touchstone still for folks. In a lot of ways, you know, that's what put Revere back under the public consciousness. Mm-hmm. 1860, of course, and the 61 issue for Paul Revere's ride. So it's both, of course, in a lot of ways, a boost. I mean, so many people have had the experience of memorizing some of the poem, all the poem growing up. We can talk as we go through, of course, of all the different numerous appropriations of the poem and the imagery over the years. And certainly grappling with, you know, the inaccuracies in the poem as well. So it's both, you know, it's a double-edged sword of putting Revere on the map in the 1860s. The house is preserved, you know, almost exactly 40 years after that, in a moment when a lot of historic homes were being destroyed in Boston. So in some ways, you know, we're certainly grateful for the for the poem and the house being there, but in a lot of ways, it's a Sisyphean task of unraveling a lot of the inaccuracies that come from not just the poem itself, and then, of course, how it's remembered and used over, and has been used over numerous decades.
Sure. Thank you. Emily, I'm going to let you ask the next question.
Great. Thank you. So do each of you remember the first time you encountered or read these poems? And can you tell us a little bit about it and your initial reaction?
So my initial reaction was that I loved the literature itself. But I had a lot of questions, having studied as well Acadian history and the ethnic cleansing that went on from 1755 to 1763 and the thousands of Acadians it affected. I was surprised that the author did not dwell or did not share more details. And I understand now that the story was more about his heroine, Evangeline, who is portrayed as very pure and saint-like and in some ways very submissive, but her defining characteristic is the constancy with which she loves her fiancé, Gabriel. And so they are separated, and for the rest of her life, which is perhaps 20 years, she spends her time wandering, looking for Gabriel. And that really did not sound credible to me, because I knew that the Acadian people was, and the culture was very matriarchal, and Acadian women were strong women. They would have 10 to 15 children. This is another discrepancy in the poem where it seems that the two main families have one child each, and that is did not sound right. Also, the poem depicts a village and a sense of peace and prosperity that also is almost idyllic, almost like the creation of a myth or an Eden, a paradise. And I say all of this, and even to this day, when I read the poem and I reach the end, I cry. In spite of all of that, because it is a beautifully written poem, and how can one not be touched by this demonstration of love?
I can speak to my experience with Paul Revere's Right as well. Not as well, I think, as Louise can speak to Evangeline, but I am from the Midwest myself, actually, cornfields of central Illinois originally, so a little bit south of where you are, Katrina. But so my first memory is, you know, as a youth, I think reading it in school, but I reflect on it, it was actually, I remember it being baked into one of the cheers that the cheerleading squad would do. Like the cheer actually started with, "Listen, my children, you shall hear the midnight ride of Paul Revere." So maybe that goes to the, you know, sing-songy nature of some of the poems, and you can obviously riff on it from there. But, you know, starting with that, having it, you know, the experiences, I think, you know, not everyone certainly, but, you know, a decent amount of school children do, having that experience and being exposed to it, you know, as a youth, you come away with some of these stories of knowing, okay, well, you know, I guess, you know, Boston and Paul Revere must have been important at, you know, the start of the American Revolution, but clearly having that sort of this imagination of the lone figure, of this kind of lone hero, which as we know is precisely wrong in a lot of ways with what was occurring. So it's definitely, you know, evoking these themes of the solo solitary figure that I think especially resonates with you know, with interested, which maybe isn't always the case, you know, ended up in history with interested seventh graders and, you know, in history. So kind of setting up that image that, of course, then I think in a lot of ways becomes somewhat hard to break down. So yeah, from a youthful exposure to the poem to, you know, obviously continuing to work on it a few decades after that.
So I grew up in northern Wisconsin, like very close to Lake Superior. And it honestly, it feels like the poem has always kind of been in my periphery. Probably doesn't hurt that my dad is a retired English teacher and would, like, you know, quote Hamlet at dinner and stuff like that. But I mean, those now infamous lines, right? You know, by the shores of Gitche Gumee, by the shining Big Sea water, you know, it just kind of felt like something we were born knowing. And, you know, I honestly don't remember my first encounter with it, because I just feel like I've always known of it. It's just kind of always been there. But it was really fascinating to come back to it now. And, you know, Lise and Robert have both talked about some of the inaccuracies that are, you know, within both of those poems. And with Hiawatha, there's also a lot at stake there. And, you know, there are a lot of omissions, there are a lot of inaccuracies, you know, particularly about, you know, around this conflation of Hiawatha with our trickster figure, you know, this cultural hero of Nabujo. And Ojibwe scholar Gerald Visner has actually written about how Nanabujo represents what he calls a spiritual balance in a comic drama, rather than the romantic elimination of human contradictions and evil. And Visner actually argues that Longfellow sanitized the trickster nature of Nanabujo and transformed him into this, like, isolated and sentimental tragic hero, rather than this really complex figure of Ojibwe legend. And so I think, you know, really taking a look at what that means, right? You know, the questions of artistic license versus historical accuracy, I think, are really crucial when we have, when we talk about poems like this, and particularly when we're talking about key events and figures, you know, throughout this.
Thank you. Now, I know, I don't know if Emily has this same experience, but at the Wadsworth Longfellow House, when we're kind of bringing people into the house for the first time, and I'll ask them, you know, a little bit like, are any of you fans of Henry's poetry, or are you familiar with his poetry? And if I get like some blank looks or some shrugs, these are usually the three poems I mention. I'll say, oh, do you know Paul Revere's Ride, Hiawatha, Evangeline? And then the little light bulb goes off. These are the poems that he's best remembered for. So I'm hoping you could each maybe talk just a little bit about what inspired Longfellow to write these poems. Like, what do we know? What do we know about the background? Why did he sit down one day and decide to pen these stories?
In the case of Evangeline, it's very interestingly, in 1840, Longfellow invited his friend, Nathaniel Hawthorne, to dinner. And Hawthorne brought with him Reverend Horace Connolly, who is the one who shared the story of an Acadian couple who were separated on their wedding day by the great upheaval. That is what Acadians have called these years, the expulsion of the French Catholics of Nova Scotia. The fiancée, Evangeline, wandered for years in hopes of finding her lover. And Longfellow called it the best illustration of faithfulness and constancy of woman that I have ever heard or read. He asked for Hawthorne's blessing to turn it into a poem. Instructing or preparing for the writing of the poem, Longfellow did search literature and also from. There was not much of Acadian history out there in the 1840s. So some of it was written from the perspective of French authors, and others were written by from the perspective of French Canadian authors, but this was a separate colony than Acadia. Longfellow also read novels written quite similar to what his intention was, and that is another story of a separation of Acadians, Acadian lovers who were separated by this British ethnic cleansing. And so that was the basis. At some point, though, I've read that some authors think that in writing the poem and not putting the blame or a responsibility of the forced removal of Acadians on New England Americans, Longfellow might have had a political goal in mind. This was not that long, relatively, I guess, after the American independence. And so, although we have yet to confirm that it was, but it is a truth that is a glaring neglect or absence in the poem, and that is the British commanders, the governors, for example, of Nova Scotia and Massachusetts, although they suggest the plan, they called it a great and noble scheme, there was no way they could pull it off without the ships, the vessels, the captains, and the men of the New England colonies.
Longfellow drew a lot of inspiration from the work of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft, who was an early, 19th century geographer, geologist, ethnologist. Schoolcraft did a lot of early studies of Native cultures. He wrote this like massive 6-volume study that was published in the 1850s. But the key to Schoolcraft's knowledge was his wife, Jane Johnston, who was Ojibwe through her mother's lineage. And so much of what Schoolcraft learned, he learned from his wife. He learned it from his mother-in-law, from his wife's family. But Schoolcraft also wasn't really particularly accurate in some of his transcriptions and things like that. And so Longfellow is taking liberty with Schoolcraft's work that was often an inaccurate retelling of what he learned from his wife and her family. And I also just want to point out that Jane Johnston was herself a writer. She was a poet. She wrote traditional stories. She translated Ojibwe works into English. She's actually considered the first known Native woman writer, the first known Native poet, the first known poet to write in a Native language, and the first known Native writer of traditional stories. And I think the fact that she is so often left out of these conversations, particularly around something like this, right? You know, around the Song of Hiawatha and Longfellow's work. And, you know, this is a bit of a side note, but so Jane Johnston Schoolcraft passes in 1842, and her husband remarries a woman named Mary Howard in 1847, who actually published a best-selling anti-Uncle Tom novel in 1860. And so that to me is always, it's always fascinating to me to try to think about the differences there, right? You know, his first wife is this really incredible writer and poet and holds all of this knowledge that then gets transformed into something that she might not have even recognized, mm-hmm. right? By the time we get to Longfellow.
Interesting.
Yeah, so for Longfellow and Paul Revere's right, I'll start with the deep cut theory from our executive director, Nina Zanieri. So in 1779, Paul Revere led part of the artillery train at what ended up, in Maine, ended up being one of the greatest, probably the greatest naval disaster for the Americans during the American Revolution at Penobscot. Second in charge for the land forces there was a man named Peleg Wadsworth. Revere and Wadsworth clashed heads throughout this disaster for the Americans. Both end up, leading retreats back. Revere himself is briefly placed under house arrest when he gets back to his house. It's an absolute disaster for Revere. He pushes for court-martials time and time and time again, basically wastes about 5 years of his life trying to unravel this thing, which ultimately he's absolved on the charges, but career setback, personal life setback, et cetera. So Nina always has this theory that Peleg Wadsworth, very old age, sits down little Henry on his knee and it says, you know what? I did Revere wrong. I did this guy, Paul Revere, wrong. And it sits and sits and sits and sits, because if nothing else, it is very ironic then that Henry Wadsworth Longfellow is the one who ultimately, boosts Paul Revere. But in reality here, for Longfellow, the poem comes out of essentially a walking tour of the North End in 1860. Mm-hmm. It's something that Longfellow had done previously. He took Dickens through the same area of the North End for Boston History on one of Dickens' visits. And for Longfellow, it was an anti-slavery tract at this moment of reflection, back on American history at the moment that the nation was about to tear itself in two. He, of course, had been pushed to voice abolitionism more by his close friend Charles Sumner for this particular trip in 1860. He was actually going through the North End with Sumner's brother, George Sumner. And it's something that Longfellow felt strongly about through his life. I think in one of his reflections that, of course, he had written some anti-slavery literature before, but it said something to the effect of, that they were so mild that even a slave owner could eat it before breakfast and not lose his appetite. So he's very, very tepid in doing so. But Longfellow was looking at this moment in the nation's history, reflecting back upon Revere, we are almost certain that Longfellow would have known about Revere, because Revere himself wrote three accounts of his ride, two contemporaneously in 1775, but then he wrote one for the founding of the Massachusetts Historical Society in 1798, which was published in the New England Magazine in 1832. That issue also had some of Longfellow's first publications. So almost certainly Longfellow would have read that, would have been familiar with it, and of course, you know, took off on the story from there, having some of those, you know, factual elements, you know, available to him, and then of course, you know, kind of embellishing and taking the story from there. But it was, you know, it was a political writing from Longfellow, and of course ended up being published the exact day that South Carolina seceded from the Union in late 1860.
Thank you.
So the next question, folks have started to touch on some of this, and this is a topic of much conversation among the staff of the Longfellow House in Cambridge. One of the things that's often brought up when Henry Longfellow's historically inspired poetry is discussed are the historical inaccuracies of these poems. So could you each speak a little bit to some of the inaccuracies in Evangeline, Hiawatha, and Paul Revere's Ride? And do you think that Longfellow's inclusion of these inaccuracies or omission of crucial pieces of information was intentional or out of ignorance? Are these inaccuracies a problem? You know, noting we could certainly point to creative examples of entertainment today inspired by history that contains some inaccuracies. So are these inaccuracies problematic? And if so, how and why?
Okay, yeah, so for Paul Revere's Ride, I do think it's something that Longfellow was aware of. I think there's also that reference in one of his poems as well. You know, not to let the historian blame the poet here if perchance he misses, you know, a date or year, which a lot of the inaccuracies with the poem itself do have to do with timing and dates and location. So I don't think it was a big deal for Longfellow, and I don't think he was going for accuracy. He's trying to stir emotion with this. Of course, he's trying to inspire and awake Northern audiences to this threat to the nation. I mean, literally, the country's about to be split in two. Longfellow sees that. I think people see that, and he's trying to arouse, you know, feelings and sentiments and push for both an end to slavery and you know, preservation of the Union. So Longfellow, you know, really does, again, he highlights Revere as the solitary figure, which I think is a much easier story when that's just simply not the case. I think, honestly, a lot of what happened that night ends up being a far better story than what Longfellow put out. It's, you know, Revere knowing that there was going to be some major action from the British through major espionage that they'd put together for months and months, that the soldiers were going to be marching out into the countryside. Revere himself doing some recon a few days before, knowing that a mission like his couldn't be set to one person alone. So Revere helping conceive of the lantern signal system that we're, you know, all familiar with, and one if by land, two if by sea, Revere helping to conceive that. So Revere wasn't waiting for that signal on the other side of the Charles River. He, in fact, was putting it into motion that night, having the two lanterns hung by, you know, friends of his. He's rowed across the harbor by two other individuals, Bentley and Richardson. There's a rented horse waiting for him on the other side of the river. So it's all, you know, these series of other figures. And of course, William Dawes being the other writer coming out of Boston specifically. And they both connect with other writers to set into motion a, you know, kind of a wildfire system for the night. So in no way is this a story of a solitary figure. Revere is evading patrols along the way. He finishes his mission, which was to get to Lexington to John Hancock and Samuel Adams. Longfellow has him breezing right through Lexington about 1 a.m. when he got there about midnight. He does. Decided to press their luck to try to get on to the, you know, the next town. They meet up with a third writer, Dr. Samuel Prescott. At this point, Revere is held by a patrol for a time, which of course is nowhere in the poem. He's threatened, you know, at gunpoint, gun at his head, is able to somewhat talk his way out of the situation and gets back to Lexington Green about a half hour before some of the first shots ring out at the first battle, really, of the Revolution. So it's, you know, all these other elements that are left out by Longfellow. And again, he almost certainly knows of all of them. But that's not really the point for him in writing any of this. So I don't think the inaccuracies really bothered him one bit with his actual production.
This is a question that is always fascinating, right? This question of how much, quite honestly, right? How much does history matter? Particularly if we're thinking about these pieces, right, that have quite literally become embedded into kind of, in a sense, like the creation story of America, right? And, you know, Kathleen, your point about how when people come to, you know, come to the site and you're like, you know, do you know who we're talking about or anything like that? And if you mention these three poems, that's what clicks for people. And so I actually did a lot of wrangling on this question of historical inaccuracies in entertainment in my book, right? And it's, it like kills my historian heart to say this. And I think Robert had some of, those same feelings too. But at some point down the line, it is no longer the history that matters. It is the myth that it has created. And, you know, again, here, I mentioned earlier how Longfellow completely misconstrues, you know, who a figure that plays quite literally one of the most central foundations in Ojibwe culture, right, in Ojibwe history. And so in that aspect, right, at some point, folks want what is familiar. They want what they know, and particularly when it comes to Native histories, and particularly when those pieces start to get kind of muddied, they start to get a little bit fuzzy around the outside. But at some point, right, like they want the myth as opposed to the actual history. And so I think with a poem like the Song of Hiawatha, and, you know, this story he tells and the way he, in a sense, recreates his own version of this. And I think, you know, what Robert said about how, in essence, he like recreates this entire historical event, I think is really foundational to understanding, not necessarily why he did it, right? He's writing in the mid-19th century, and it's not like anybody's really going to call him out in that moment. But it's important to understand the inaccuracies, even if folks maybe kind of just like jump to defend what it has become.
I think, and I want to let Lise answer this question too, but something that Katrina just said really reminds me of that famous line from the end of the movie, "The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance," which is, when the story becomes the legend, print the legend. That's why I think you're right. That's what people want. It's what they remember. It's what sticks with us. And Longfellow, I think, really as a writer, set out to want to give America its national literature. And with poems like these, that's what he does. And that image of the lone hero on horseback, whether it's that guy or the devoted wife, the myth of, you know, indigenous people are disappearing, and it, you know, this is what we have left. That's what sticks with us, whether we realize it or not. Lise, I'm going to give you a chance to speak to that question.
Yeah, I find this very fascinating because it's the inaccuracies that essentially fueled Acadians to research, write, and become their own people. they underwent a terrible ethnic cleansing. And what is depicted in the poem, it does not account for the groups of Acadian farmers and fishermen who assembled and tried to fight off the British, who liberated Acadians from prison, who fought the British, who tried to escape. This went on for years. There is even a story, and I'm going to open this parenthesis because it relates directly to the settlement of the Madawaska territory. In 1755, there was a ship. The ship had just pulled anchor, and it had 252 prisoners aboard. The ship was called the Pemmican, and the destination was North Carolina. So what happened is there were few American mercenaries and British soldiers aboard, and the Acadians overtook the crew. And they steered the boat to the mouth of the St. John River. The St. John River actually goes right up to this area throughout New Brunswick and Maine, and then joins throughout the province of Quebec to the St. Lawrence Seaway. It was known as the communication highway. So these Acadians who've mastered the boat literally walk to Quebec because they have an opportunity to escape. This little girl, 8 years old, and her sister were prisoners with their family. And they all escaped to the lower St. Lawrence area of Quebec. One of the little girls grows up and she comes back to the area of at the mouth of the St. John River where Acadians had hoped to settle in a permanent village. And she marries one of the Sear brothers, Sear, C-Y, and eventually is part of the group 16 families who settled in the Madawaska territory. So she would have told, and everybody with her, her oral history was extremely important. It, what she went through, even as a child, became who she was, and she was proud of that, proud of the fact that she was part of people of survival. So there were, the Acadian population was three quarters of the population of 18,000 were forcibly removed and then sent off. These were French Catholics. They were sent off to English Protestant states. Yes, they were British colonies. They would in time become American states. The American states did not want them. What were they going to do with these extra mouths to feed? They were not to be treated as free people. Therefore, some were put in prisons and some were used as slave labor. The families were all, and none of the members of the families knew where the others went because the destination of the ships was kept secret. Everybody thought they were going back to France because they did call it a deportation, which doesn't make sense anyway, because they were born in Acadie. Yeah. But they did hope that they would see their family again. So these removed and chase and dying and scalping, those lasted 8 years. And by the end of it, the land that Acadians had cultivated reaped from, it was no longer theirs. It had been actually given to the American Rangers and American mercenaries who helped carry out the orders of the deportation. So when the poem became known in the Maritime Provinces where Acadians resettled after the Treaty of Paris, it became known through inserts in a French newspaper after it was translated. So the poem was seen as almost as a moral victory, because Acadians had been silent for 100 years, doing as Antonin Maillet, the foremost Acadian writer, says, hiding in the woods so as not to awaken the sleeping giant. And finally, with the explosion of the poem and its reverberations throughout the world, there was finally someone talking about the horrible fact that had happened to the Acadians. And Acadians saw this as a form of vindication. And in time, the heroine, Evangeline is not even an Acadian name. It was completely invented by Longfellow. And after the poem was published, everybody called their daughters Evangeline. And the marketing went wild. I mean, there were Evangeline fried clams and Evangeline, everything was Evangeline, Evangeline Trail. And it was also, she became the rallying cry of the National Convention of Acadians that was trying to bring together this people that had been so dispersed, and in not only getting them together, but finding a reason for them to solidify their identity in forms of a flag, a national anthem, a slogan, all of this, and giving themselves the tools to become an assertive voice, where even then in the 1880s, they were still seen as marginalized because they were part of the French population, but the authority, the political powers, everything in capitalism and education, it was absolutely totally governed by Anglophones. And so in a way, these inaccuracies spurred Acadians to take matters into their own hands.
Thank you. Now, this next question, not to leave out Robert, but this next question really speaks to specifically to Evangeline and Hiawatha, and you, Katrina and Lise, you've touched upon this a little bit already. But today, Longfellow, writing about communities and peoples that he himself was not a part of, specifically Acadian and Indigenous communities, in the way that he did, is certainly seen as problematic and possibly even contributing to the erasure of those people. So I wonder, can you talk a little bit about more about why that is? Does this mean that we shouldn't read those poems today? Like, do those poems still have value, or should we just be more careful to approach them differently and more critically? And can you think of, and again, you've already kind of mentioned some examples, some the works of some authors who have told the same stories or similar stories who are from those communities. So if Longfellow maybe made these stories famous, who are some other writers that might speak to them, you know, in a more, from their own personal experience? I'll let Katrina go first.
So I'm a historian, right? And I deal with all kinds of sources that, you know, whether they're poems, whether they're newspaper articles, you know, photographs, paintings, all these things. And I am not here to say that we should stop reading the Song of Hiawatha, because I don't think we should stop reading the Song of Hiawatha. What sources like this do, what poems like this do, just like, you know, the drawings of George Catlin, the photographs of Edward Curtis, they help us understand the context of this particular historical period. And this one gives us a chance to see how white Americans saw Native people in the mid-19th century. You know, one of the key things towards the end of the poem is Hiawatha is seen as welcoming, you know, these missionaries, these figures of assimilation. And, you know, there's that line where it says, listen to their words of wisdom, listen to the truth they tell you, for the master of life has sent them from the land of light and morning. And so this is, he's taking these Ojibwe legends and attaching them, in a sense, to the arrival of white settlers. And so it really demonstrates, quite literally, you know, in this literary sense, the goals of federal Indian policy, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have, in this era, people, you know, you have the federal government, you have missionaries, you have military officials who are just hoping that Native people will disappear, whether it is through assimilation and conversion to Christianity, whether they just kind of keep moving westward or quite literally disappear. And so this really underscores, right, a lot of those thought processes of this time period. And, you know, I mentioned Jane Johnston Schoolcraft, I mentioned Gerald Bisner, but there are so many, many fabulous, you know, historians, artists, writers that do a lot of this fabulous work. And again, like I said, I'm not saying like nobody should ever read the Song of Hiawatha again. But what I'm hoping is that folks can see, maybe look at it with a little more of a critical lens. We can still appreciate it for what it is, but it's also important to recognize what is underscoring this poem.
Thank you. Lise, did you have anything you want to add?
I also share the sentiment expressed by Katrina. When I teach Acadian literature, I always include Evangeline. It's a beautiful poem. It introduces the reader, and any good teacher will contextualize and provide additional information that surrounds the poem and fills in the blanks, if you will. I think it's a beautiful poem, and in spite of, you know, all the inaccuracies and neglects and missed opportunities, let's say, it remains a very readable poem. And as I said, you know, a love story is universal. It appeals to all generations throughout time as well. But I do think that the poem has to be placed in the context of real Acadian history, actually what actually happened, and how the poem can be a force as well. What happened in the Maritime Provinces with the Acadian Renaissance also happened in Louisiana, where Acadians landed, or they deliberately went to after the Treaty of Paris was signed, And after having been exiled either in France or from Haiti, and then they went to Louisiana. So there's a great deal of good that ultimately came from, you know, however wrong the depiction was at the time. And I believe there is still much to learn. In fact, the poem was written in 1847. There was a song that was called Evangeline that really mirrors the poem quite dramatically. But there was a remake of a song also called Evangeline. And in the song, the factual history was inserted in such a way that the love story remains, but the history is correct. And that song came out maybe 10 years ago, and it is still one of the most popular songs of the area. I mean, it's astounding.
Thank you.
Can I just add something briefly on this, mm-hmm. on the subject, Kathleen? So I absolutely agree with both Katrina and Lise, and I think using, as Katrina was saying, you know, using these poems as sources themselves for the moment in time that they're coming out and what broader things that they're speaking to. So with that in context for Paul Revere's Ride, of course, this is Longfellow trying to inspire Northerners at this time of Civil War being about to break out, but he actually leaves out a major piece of evidence that perhaps is a bit damning that Revere himself actually included, which is this reference that anybody had, presumably in Massachusetts and the area would have understood from Revere's context. He's noting his ride and he references where Mark hung in chains, which is a reference to a 1750 incident where a man, enslaved man Mark, sometimes referred to as Mark Codman for his owner's last name, had conspired to murder John Codman, his owner. Obviously, a very serious crime at the time for some obvious reasons and implications. Mark was not only hung, but then was gibbeted for years after. So an absolute, you know, grisly physical marker of slavery and of a push against slavery in the North, in the Boston area, in Massachusetts, that Revere himself is calling out, actually, is just kind of a historical marker of something that everyone would know. That, of course, is absent from Longfellow's, right? And of course, he's not including that, as that in a lot of ways, I think we could read it as an omission that, of course, would in a lot of ways implicate, you know, the North in slavery. Of course, Massachusetts had long abolished slavery by that point, but in Revere's writing, of course, in the 75 ones, of course, not at that stage yet, and still writing to this very grisly and visceral, you know, imagery of that just in the neighborhood that Longfellow is writing about.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Thanks for mentioning that, Robert.
All right. So, like we are coming up to the top of the hour, but we'd love to hear still a little bit of reflection on sort of the contemporary legacy of these poems. So, you know, these works and Longfellow may not have quite the recognition today that they did in the 19th century, but if folks could just reflect a little bit on, you know, is Longfellow still relevant today? And where do you still see the legacy of these poems in the 21st century?
My answer to that is fairly easy, mostly because we still have Minnehaha Falls. It is still a huge, you know, not only tourist destination, but also places, you know, it's a place that people in the cities go to every summer. And we have roads, like I mentioned at the beginning, that are Hiawatha Avenue and Minnehaha Avenue that quite literally run parallel to each other. And the poem also became the basis for a number of plays and pageants, and Michael McNally has written about this too and has shown how when it becomes a theatrical production, it becomes really embedded into a lot of the tourist economies of towns around the Great Lakes that are again capitalizing on that either actual geographic proximity or their like somewhat loosely based claims. And so I think the legacy of the Song of Hiawatha lives on in multiple ways, both in terms of geography and tourism.
Yeah, I think for Paul Revere's right, I think absolutely. I mean, the resonance is all over the place, as we see in any, I mean, just now seen in the past couple of weeks, Domino's commercials of, you know, the savings are coming, which of course is then taking this, the British are coming phrase, which didn't exist, and kind of, you know, working that into the Longfellow, you know, story, but it's there. I mean, we see in one of the files I've pulled recently, we see, of course, Sean Hannity as you know, the writer in the night. We see Greta Thunberg as the, you know, the writer. So, you know, we see all of these appropriations still of the imagery of the story of Revere being, you know, again, this solitary figure in, into the night on all ends of the political spectrum of the commercial spectrum as well. So I think in a lot of ways, you know, the resonance is still there. I mean, it would be hard to say on, you know, if it's decreasing, increasing. I think it's staying in terms of, you know, the poem itself and you know, how we're seeing it used, not just domestically, but in some of these cases internationally as well. So the resonance is absolutely still there. So you know, just going back to Katrina's point, I think even more the reason to actually grapple with this in its time as a source from that moment.
I think the poem Evangeline is very much still relevant because really what Longfellow is depicting is the way a people with authority treat people who are different. And that has universal repercussions, right? We see that every day. We see that with immigrants. We see that with people who think differently, look different, speak another language. We don't see the different as equal, not the same. We see them as different is bad still. So in terms of bringing that story forth, I believe that Longfellow was trying to redress in some way, or, you know, bring either closure or show that it was an irreparable damage done to really quite a simple and people who this was not a time of war. And I think it's still a valid lesson today.
I know we're coming up to the end of our time. I want to be respectful of our panelists' schedules and everybody that's tuning in. I do have one more question for our panelists before we part. I know we got a couple questions coming in from the audience that I've been looking at. And I think we did address a lot of the aspects of those questions, so that if there was a question in our audience that we didn't really have time to address, or you're thinking about this and you'd like a little more information on something, maybe you'd like more information on Longfellow's childhood home in Portland, Maine, or the home you had as an adult in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or you want to get in touch with any of these scholars just to learn a little bit more about anything they touched on tonight, email me at kneumann@mainhistory.org. And I'm happy to try and tackle a question myself, or to pass it on to the person in this group that would be the best person to answer it. I've also been sharing links in the chat to the poems that we mentioned tonight, to some other great resources, to where you can find Katrina Phillips' book, Staging Identity. I've got the link for that. Paul Revere House, I know Robert said you guys are doing a virtual tour of the house later this week. I've got the link to your organization, and I know Longfellow House in Cambridge, you guys have some great stuff coming up, I think, including some more things to mark Henry's birthday in Cambridge. So be sure to check those out.
But one last question for you all as we kind of wrap this up. What's one thing you hope that people who study these poems can learn or can take away from the great discussion that we've had here tonight?
I suppose in a sentence from a historical perspective on the poem, that Revere and the story of the house is more than the ride, and the ride and the night of April 18th, 19th is more than Revere. So, you know, a lot of aspects to dig into all around. And the fact that I think we kind of concurred here that, you know, the poem still resonates, that in some ways can be still inspiring, this call to action broadly construed, but of course I think needs to be, again, taken in its context, as that can be applied in any number of ways, both I guess depending on whose perspective it is, in good and bad ways as well. So having that context is really important.
I would say, you know, recognizing the nuances here, right? And, you know, we've all said it multiple times that, you know, we can appreciate the work that Longfellow did, but we can also understand that, again, he's writing from a particular viewpoint that isn't one that is, I would hope, you know, not what we consider to be the dominant view now. Mm. And so, you know, just, and this isn't going to surprise anybody, but, you know, if folks are interested in learning more about Native history and Indigenous history, to seek out the works of these Native scholars who do, you know, really just fantastic work in the field of Native American and Indigenous studies.
I agree. I think the literature has an important role to play in disseminating information about cultures, about historical events. And I hope readers get curious enough to seek out historical text that will bring to life the literature itself or run parallel to it.
Thank you. You guys have all been amazing. This has been really interesting. I've learned some new things this evening. It's been great to hear from you all. We've had a great audience who've asked some great questions and made some great observations. And I'm sure we could go on for another hour, but unfortunately, that's not going to happen tonight. But maybe we can, hopefully we'll all meet again, whether it's virtually or in person, to talk more about history, to talk more about Henry, and to talk a little more poetry. Emily, is there anything that you wanted to add as we close?
No, just to say thank you so much to all of the panelists, and thank you to Kathleen and the Maine Historical Society for inviting us to partner on this wonderful program. And I too hope to continue these conversations with everyone here, panelists and audience alike.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Emily, and National Park Service for co-hosting with us. And thank you to Lise, Katrina, Robert. You guys were wonderful, and you'd be welcome back to collaborate with us again anytime.